English Radio. Coming up is the news.
President Ibrahim Raisi says developing relations with Africa is a priority for Iran as he sets off for an official tour of three African nations. Sudan's army rejects a proposal to allow deployment to foreign peacekeepers in the country, saying it will consider them enemy forces. Russia warns against NATO's increasing military assistance to Ukraine, saying such assistance could bring World War III closer. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, the Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi set off on an official tour of Africa, which will take him to Kenya, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. Speaking to reporters, Raisi said development of Iran's relations with African countries is a priority for his administration's foreign policy, adding Iran seeks to expand relations with African nations while respecting their sovereignty and independence. Raisi said some countries take a colonialistic approach to Africa, but Iran's approach is based on dignity and synergism with African nations. The Iranian president said there are great potentials for expansion of ties between Iran and Africa. This will be the first visit to Africa by an Iranian president in 11 years. Raisi is visiting three African states on official invitations from their respective presidents. Iran's foreign ministers urge European countries, including Sweden, to take urgent and effective measures to deter further desecration of Islamic sanctities.
We urge the Swedish and other European authorities to take urgent and effective measures. Mr. President, any doubts or delays in condemning and preventing such actions only reinforce perception of double standards and justify abuses of freedom of expression.
Hossein Emir Abdullahian made the remarks during a UN Human Rights Council meeting to debate alarming rise in public acts of religious hatred. In the meeting, a number of Muslim states called for accountability over the desecration of the Quran, including in Sweden last month. Pakistan's top diplomat said that acts of desecration were permitted by Western governments and carried out with a sense of impunity. The Indonesian foreign minister called desecration of the Quran an act of Islamophobia and demanded a halt to the abuse of freedom of expression. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk also called for efforts to combat the weaponization of religious differences for political purposes. Meanwhile, Yemen's Ministry of Trade is calling on all Muslim nations to follow Sana'a's example and ban all Swedish products after desecration of the Holy Quran in the European country. Yusuf Mowry has your details.
To protest last week's burning of the Holy Quran in Stockholm, the Ansar Allah-backed Yemeni government has officially banned all Swedish imports into Yemen. This means the Yemeni market will no longer carry almost 500 Swedish brands. The desecration of the Quran has sparked Muslim outrage and condemnation against the Swedish government, who continue to insist the sacrilegious act is a part of freedom of speech.
It is a revolutionary Yemeni people who decided that Swedish products should be banned from Yemen. We also call on all neighboring countries and the Islamic world to take a decisive stand against this act of aggression against Islam. At the very least, Muslim nations should ban all Swedish products.
According to the Minister of Trade, the Sana'a government has put together an economic plan to boost the battered Yemeni economy and compensate for the products which have been banned. They believe this will help Yemen move towards self-sufficiency.
The ban on Swedish products only took place after much research and study on pragmatic solutions needed to replace the banned products. There are going to be many positive steps and decisions the government will take in order to increase and promote local production to stimulate the economy
that has been involved in what they described as a war on Islam.
The banning of products from Sweden, Israel, the United States and the UK is an obligation on all Muslims worldwide. This is because of the hate and aggression these nations have toward Muslims and Islam. These are people who do not respect the religion of Allah. The banning of products from these nations is a positive step forward to teach them a lesson so that we can depend on ourselves and increase local production and industry.
The Ansarullah-backed Yemeni government said it is funding plans and initiatives to revive Yemeni production. This is necessary in order to provide food security for millions of Yemenis who have suffered tremendously from food shortages caused by the 8 year of Saudi-imposed blockade on Yemen.
The fact is, although boycotting goods from nations that support insulting Islam has some impact, it is simply not enough. This is why the Sana'a government is calling for a united Islamic front to cut off all ties with Sweden and any nation involved in sacrilegious acts against Islam. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Israeli forces have evicted another Palestinian family from their home in occupied East Al-Quds, replacing them with settlers. Regime forces stormed the house and arrested several activists. Families lived in their home for 70 years. Earlier this year, an Israeli court ordered a Sub-Laban family to vacate their house in favor of settlers. Family fought a 45-year-old legal battle against regime-backed settler groups trying to take their land. A Palestinian civil society and rights groups have slammed the move, saying that forcible transfer, which constitutes both a war crime and a crime against humanity under Rome Statute. UN says 218 Palestinian households in East Al-Quds face a threat of eviction. Israel occupied East Al-Quds along the entire West Bank during the 1967 war. It formally annexed the city in 1980, a move never recognized by the international community. Sudan's Army-aligned foreign ministry has rejected a regional summit's proposal to allow deployment of peacekeeping forces to protect civilians in the war-ravaged country. The ministry said in a statement that Sudan will view any foreign forces deployed there as enemy forces. Summit was held in the Ethiopian capital by East African Regional Body, IGAD, on Monday, attended by Kenya, South Sudan, Djibouti, and Ethiopia. The Sudanese army refused to take part in the meeting, accusing Kenya, which chaired the talks, of favoring the rival paramilitary rapid support forces. Meanwhile, fighting has been raging on in and around the capital, Khartoum. Sudan's conflict began in mid-April over a power struggle between Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and former Deputy Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who commands RSF. Russia has warned that NATO's increased military assistance to Ukraine could bring World War III closer. Deputy Chairman of the Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, said such military aid will not deter Russia from achieving its goals in Ukraine. He made the remarks on the first day of NATO's summit in Lithuania, where several countries pledged more arms and financial support for Kiev. Medvedev also hinted at the use of cluster bombs by Russia, citing reports of Ukraine already using them. Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu had said earlier Moscow will be forced to use similar weapons if the U.S. provides Kiev with cluster munitions. The U.S. also announced it will supply Ukraine with cluster munitions that release large numbers of smaller bomblets, which can kill indiscriminately over wide areas. Cluster munitions are banned by over 120 countries, including most NATO members. French President Emmanuel Macron says Paris has agreed to supply Ukraine with long-range missiles. This after Britain said it will provide Ukraine with similar missiles, and we discussed this issue with our guests earlier in our news review program. Now welcome everyone to the news review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. France joins Britain in supplying Ukraine with long-range cruise missiles called Scalp, a move that allows Ukrainian forces to hit Russian troops deep behind the front lines. French President Emmanuel Macron made the announcement at a summit of the NATO alliance in Lithuania. French sources said countries already made a delivery of the missiles. Now, Britain said in May it was supplying its own version of the missile. The French version has a range of about 250 kilometers, three times longer than Ukraine's existing missile capacities. French authorities have suggested Ukraine has given them guarantees it won't fire the missiles into Russian territory. This as Washington's vowed to supply internationally banned cluster munitions to Ukraine. The U.S. is facing a chorus of criticism over its decision, including from China.
Responsible provision of cluster munitions is highly likely to cause humanitarian issues. Humanitarian concerns and legitimate military and security needs should be addressed in a balanced manner, and the transfer of cluster munitions should be treated with prudence and restraint.
Mao said dialogue's only viable way out of the Ukraine crisis. She urged parties involved to the conflict to avoid fanning the flames of the war. Separately, North Korea's foreign minister slammed the U.S., calling its decision a dangerous criminal act. Even Washington's Western allies, including the U.K., Canada, and Spain, have refused to provide the munitions. Cluster bombs were banned by a U.N. convention backed by more than 120 countries. Controversial weapons are considered a major threat to civilians as they release larger numbers of smaller bomblets that can kill indiscriminately over a wide area. Joining us now for the program is Jerome Hughes, correspondent, joining us from Brussels, and Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist, joining us from Bristol. Gentlemen, I'd like to say welcome to both of you and hope you're both doing well. I guess, Jerome, we'll start with you to get the latest. Vladimir Zelensky was pretty irate earlier. He was expecting something in terms of accession. He's getting this consolation prize of a couple missiles with longer capacity. What can you tell us about the way things have unfolded for Ukraine over the past 24 hours, Jerome?
Well, Daniel, I think even before Biden traveled to Europe for the NATO summit, he made it clear that Ukraine is not ready to join NATO. I mean, everybody knows that basically that would end up in potentially a world war simply because Russia would not tolerate that. That would be the final straw for Russia. I mean, we've already seen the expansion of NATO. In April, Finland joined NATO. Sweden is going to become the 32nd member of the military alliance. And it just has been expanding over the past 30 years, which is why Russia says that it needed to secure its, you know, geographical territorial integrity because of the expansion eastward of NATO. But Zelensky is getting everything else apart from that. I mean, you talk about these long-range missiles, but also the cluster munitions, which are banned in more than 120 countries. And also, you know, we have troops, Ukrainian troops are being trained all the time now on warplanes that are going to be supplied by the West. So when you add it all up together, there is growing disquiet here in the European Union. We're getting statements in now all the time from anti-war groups and also political groupings in the European Parliament. And they're expressing concern that Western leaders are really pushing us to a situation where we could have a nuclear war. Because the big question is, you know, at what point does the Kremlin say enough is enough? Because this is relentless. And I was speaking to one security expert in the past couple of days who said, look, the biggest problem here is complacency. Because what happened is at the start, 500 days ago or whatever, February last year, when things escalated, at the beginning, Western leaders were terrified that things could spiral out of control altogether because, of course, Russia is such a major nuclear power. But as the days go on, as the weeks go on, as the months go on, and they keep getting away with more in terms of, you know, what many would see, or certainly what Russia would see as the provocation and this relentless supply of weapons to Ukraine, and as they keep getting away with more and more of that, they become complacent. But as this security expert said to me, that could change overnight. We could wake up one morning and hear news that, you know, things have escalated further because Russia has basically moved towards a situation where it's going to progress to potentially nuclear defense. And that can happen very quickly. So this is the big concern. And I think it's a growing concern, certainly amongst EU citizens here. I'm not sure about the United States, but certainly here, citizens in the EU, and when we hear from the civil society organizations with the statements and the anti-war groups, it's a growing concern.
Thank you there, Jerome. And Tony, welcome to the program there. Thanks for your patience. Now, Tony, ironically, we're getting assurances both to the U.S. that the so-called cluster bombs are going to be used responsibly. Supposedly, the Ukrainians give assurances that they're going to do their best to that there won't be a risk to the civilian population. I don't know if you can give that assurance, actually. And now we're getting guarantees that they're not going to use these missiles into Russian territory. But with an upset Vladimir Zelensky and a frustrated and losing Ukrainian military, what are the likelihoods that things will somehow get out of hand and escalate when you continue to give more sophisticated weaponry to basically push the Russians into maybe a decision that might pull the entire world into this thing if they're already not there?
Well, I mean, isn't it interesting about Zelensky? He makes these promises, but then, he promised when he was elected president of Ukraine that he would stop the fighting in the southeast of his country and halt the assault by the Ukrainian army on the Donbass, the breakaway regions, which massively voted, the Russian-speaking regions, to secede from Kiev. Now, so why should we trust him when he says that we won't use these Storm Shadow and the Scalp French missiles to hit Russia? And why should we trust him when he says that we will be responsible when we use these cluster bombs? So the answer, of course, is we can't trust him. And it's interesting watching him sort of stamping his feet with NATO, saying we want more weapons, more weapons. We must join NATO. Well, there's a major problem there in that the NATO charter is explicit that you cannot join NATO if you've got a border dispute or a war going on. And the question of the Ukrainian border, of course, is very much up in the air. There's a massive border, one of the biggest border dispute on the planet going on there. And so that would mean that if Ukraine was to enter NATO, NATO would be at war with Russia.
Good stuff, gentlemen. Stay safe to both of you. I want to thank you both for joining us on the program today here on Press TV. And viewers, that brings us to, name off our guest there. That was Jerome Hughes, correspondent there, joining us out of Brussels, and Mr. Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist, joining us from Bristol. And this brings us to the conclusion of this segment to your news review program, everyone. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. And welcome back, everyone. Cuban officials have slammed recent visit by U.S. nuclear-powered submarine to a military base at Guantanamo Bay as provocative escalation. The Cuba's foreign ministry said nuclear submarine was at the Guantanamo Bay military base from July 5th through July 8th. The ministry also called on the U.S. to end its military presence on the island. It said that Washington uses its base in Cuba to carry out acts of detention, torture, and systemic violation of human rights. Cuba has long called for the U.S. to close its 121-year-old naval base on the eastern part of the island, along with a military prison Washington established there in 2002. Human rights groups say the Guantanamo Bay prison has been used for arbitrary detention and the torture of people allegedly suspected of terrorism. Thanks for joining us, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می‌کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we have made you familiar in a couple of episodes with the views of British thinker Hamed Algar on Imam Khomeini. Algar, teacher of Islamic studies in Berkeley University of California, believes that the Islamic Revolution would have never triumphed without the leadership of Imam Khomeini. Today, you'll get more familiar with his views on Imam Khomeini. Stay tuned, please. Hamed Algar believes that Imam Khomeini had a stable and independent political opinion for 50 years since 1930s. The Imam's ideas were clearly manifested in his writings and speeches. Algar maintains that Imam Khomeini, besides holding ethical classes, which had political impacts, would always bolster people's relation with religious bodies. The writing of Kashful Asrar, or Exposure of Secrets, was another important measure which reveals the Imam's active participation in politics, although the book apparently defended Islam and Shia school of thought. The British thinker says that the publication of this book was a strong response to all those who had turned into the victims and agents of imperialism to disgrace and devaluate religion. Hamed Algar writes, "The increase of anti-clergy wave was the result of the Pahlavi regime's policies. Thus, the impugning of such works was considered as a political measure. In addition, parts of Kashful Asrar had explicitly and strongly censured the Pahlavi regime and attacked Reza Shah for preserving of his rule through bayonet." Algar continues, "Imam Khomeini made it clear that acceptance of the Shah by clergymen will continue as long as no other better system could be created. It was probably then that Imam Khomeini decided to overthrow the kingdom. He's surely the one who knows how to conceal his plans and, with an undefeatable strategy, judge the needs and goals which will be reacted by public opinion. Anyway, we find the first signs of the political theory of Velayat-e-Faqih in Kashful Asrar that, later on, shaped the foundations of the Islamic Republic's constitution. In this phase, this theory had not been presented yet as a clear and undeniable result of Shia belief." British University lecturer Hamed Algar believes that Imam Khomeini had not taken a clear political measure till 1962 due to safeguarding the status of marjaiyat as the source of religious guidance of the Muslim community. In other words, the great source of emulation, Grand Ayatollah Borujerdi, would refrain from serious confrontation with the regime. Moreover, Algar says that the second reason for Imam Khomeini's apparent passivity till 1962 was that some of the political leaders were not of the same opinion as Imam Khomeini. He writes, "In the years 1941 and 1953, when the religious leadership was in bad conditions and the political arena was turbulent and despairing, Imam Khomeini was mainly engaged in teaching of jurisprudence. Such an activity was an effective method to change the political and intellectual stance prevailing in Qom and also a background for instructing a generation of combatant ulema who played an important role in the events leading to the formation of the Islamic Republic. Hamed Algar maintains that the big number of students at Imam Khomeini's courses, his attempt to create basic reforms in the seminaries in order to encourage useful and novel ideas, and training of influential figures were among the top features of Imam Khomeini's classes. These factors turned the Imam into the great source of emulation after the passing away of Ayatollah Borujerdi. The British thinker writes, "The Islamic Revolution can be considered as one of the most public sources through the history of Islam, and the spiritual movement and the socio-political revival resulting from the emergence of an undeniable ethical qualification and the society's enthusiastic inclination to obey him. Such movements increased, especially in the 8th and 19th centuries, when Muslim nations were subjected to all-out assaults of imperialism." Elsewhere, he comments on the personality of Imam Khomeini. "Imam Khomeini can be considered as the heir of combatant Shia ulama and the heir of personalities like Sayyid Ismail in India, Amir Abdul Qadir in Algeria, and Sheikh Shamil in Dagestan." Algar writes on the unique character of Imam Khomeini as the important factor of victory of the Islamic Revolution. "The first phase of the revolution, which led to the annihilation of the Shah's regime, yielded without a party, a guerrilla army, or any other type of common political parties in the modern world. What played the determining role in its success was the loyalty of the masses of people, too, and their obedience of the personality who enjoyed perfect ethical qualification according to the Islamic Sunnah that is the practice." Dear listeners, on that note, we have come to the end of Hamed Algar's views on Imam Khomeini. Next time, we will touch upon the views of another thinker.
Food for thought.
Salam, everybody. Would you like to hear some hopeful words of divine mercy from the master of eloquence, Imam Ali, peace upon him? "Every person who is tempted to go astray does not deserve punishment."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Thank you. This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, if you are patient, you will receive the good news of Allah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor to be at your service, dear listeners. In today's episode, we are talking about how if you are patient, you will receive the good news from Allah. So this good news from Allah that a person who is patient will receive, of course, deals with the blessings of both this world and the hereafter. Of course, the blessings of this world are nothing compared to the blessings that will be given to the patient in the hereafter. But patience in the face of what? Well, of course, one of the things which a human being and a person must be patient in the face of are misfortunes. Of course, in our life, we find that one day or the other, a misfortune might befall us. Now, when this misfortune befalls us, how should we react, especially when taking into consideration an Islamic lifestyle? Well, one of the ways that people will unfortunately react, which is un-Islamic when it comes to our lifestyle, is to whine or complain or be sad or despair. This is not what an Islamic lifestyle teaches us. Rather, an Islamic lifestyle teaches us that when a misfortune befalls us, when a calamity befalls us, when something truly tragic happens, well, the first thing that we say is Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Surely we are from Allah, and to Him shall we return. What is interesting is that the Holy Quran very beautifully says, and give good news to the patient, who, when a misfortune befalls them, say, surely we are from Allah, and to Him we shall return. Those are they on whom are blessings and mercy from their nourishing Lord, and those are the followers of the right course. Welcome back. This is A2Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the good news that will be given to the people who are patient. Now, patience, again, is one of the pillars in an Islamic lifestyle. We talked about the verse of the Holy Quran, how Allah the Almighty says that when a misfortune befalls certain people, they say, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un, and they are patient. And it is these people that are patient who are given the good news of blessings and prosperity, both in this world and the hereafter. And it is these people that are patient who receive this good news, the good news that the blessings and the mercy of Allah are upon them. And it is these people who are patient and steadfast upon the path of Islam, despite the misfortunes that befall them, they are the ones who are the followers of the right course. And so in our lives too, we face misfortunes. But, dear friends, when we face misfortunes, we must be patient, steadfast, determined to continue the path of Islam, to be strong and powerful when it comes to fulfilling the duties and the rights and the obligations that Islam has put upon us. And so, if we are patient in our lives, despite misfortunes that come about, then we will be given the good news, this glad tidings of a beautiful hereafter that awaits us. And truly, dear friends, how long is this world, which is temporary? But when we consider the blessings of the hereafter, blessings which are eternal, then truly we realize the value and the importance of being patient.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Popular mobilization units. This is my 8th working trip to Iraq. Each time, I think to myself, it'll be my last. But now I have once again boarded a vehicle carrying me to the location of my new mission, the Mosul Liberation Operation Command Center, where the popular mobilization units are getting ready for a new offensive against Daesh. I know that I've arrived late and want to leave soon. I'd like to know the next destination, but all the people in the kitchen look new to me. And I cannot find out much, except that the catering guys are nearly finished with their job, and the forces will be dispatched very soon. The commanders are having a session in a room with cracks on its walls. I recognize the face of the base commander, Hadi Al-Amri, and ask him my question. It's hard for him to speak Farsi. He shows me the answer on his tablet. I find out that the target of the next attack is a village a few kilometers away from here, a Sunni-populated village under Daesh control for 2 years. Just like others, I know the situation and the people we're going to face. But what makes this operation distinguished to me is the discussions prior to that. The Americans are sensitive to the popular mobilization units. They put Baghdad under pressure not to involve the PMU in the Mosul liberation operation. But why? This is the question that brought me here to find its answer. The fighters scatter and try to run closer to the village as much as they can. The PMU is apparently a military force. But none of its members have military motivations. They have come to the battlefield with Daesh not following a military order, but inspired by a fatwa, the one issued by Ayatollah Sistani 2 years ago. Volunteer forces created a group called Hashd al-Shaabi, the popular mobilization unit, rushing to help the official military. Their cooperation led to the liberation of Iraqi cities one after another. 2 years into the war with Daesh, the PMU forces have turned into skilled and brave military fighters. Two years ago, when I first came among the PMU forces, each group had a flag of its own. But now all of them fight under one single flag, that of Iraq. If Daesh had not invaded Iraq, each of these people would have been working or studying in his own city or village. But the terrorist group forced them to take up arms and fight for the safety and comfort of their countrymen and women. Now the PMU is not limited to Shia forces. Christian and Sunni units have also joined the force. near the village. We had to get off the car and continue the way on foot. One fighter with an RPG launcher on his shoulder catches my eye. Apparently, the RPG launcher does not go with the denim trousers, the sneakers, and the t-shirt he's wearing. But maybe nothing could have shown the popular nature of the PMU better than his appearance. There's no shelter for the forces near the village. Everybody hides behind the heavy military vehicles to escape Daesh snipers. As the barrage of bullets starts from the village, the helicopters and the tanks also begin to fire. Daesh snipers' bullets hit the ground, sending up a cloud of dust. This shows that we are within their shooting range. The fighters scatter and try to run closer to the village as much as they can. The fighting allows me to look around amid blind bullets coming towards us and target an alley in the village. There, the Daesh terrorists have opened indiscriminate fire on the PMU. Sheltered by the gunmen's fire, the infantry try to reach the village houses. The final fighting kicks off. After a period of fighting, an explosive-laden vehicle belonging to Daesh shows up. This proves that the terrorists have lost hope in holding the village and at least want to claim some fatalities. The fighters open a barrage of bullets and RPG fire on the vehicle, but apparently they cannot cause that much damage to the fully armored car. The fighters are lucky because the Chariot of Death stops working and gets stuck somewhere between the village and the fighters. The suicide bomber inside the car, that feels desperate, blows himself up into 1,000 pieces while the car is away from the fighters. Now the Daesh terrorists have fled. It's time to clean up the village. But the threat is not completely over. Some of the PMU fighters have gathered at the entrance of a tunnel inside the village. I follow them in, after ensuring that the fighters have entered the tunnel before. The tunnel is full of twists and bounds, and at some places branches into different paths. From the effort Daesh has put into digging the tunnel, it is clear that it didn't want to lose the village easily. Only God knows how long it takes to dig such a tunnel in this rock-hard soil with basic tools such as a shovel. Daesh terrorists are fleeing in the other side of the village. For now, nobody plans to hunt them. The PMU forces are now focused on mopping up the houses, but it seems no one's home. The village is quiet and calm. It looks a bit suspicious. Things turn out to be normal. The PMU forces tear the flag apart, and I think to myself that this flag, with the sacred notes on it, looks exactly like the Quran the Bani Umayyad dynasty put on spears, and is only good for deceiving the credulous. The documents left behind shows this room had been the public court of Daesh. Daesh is apparently a Sunni group, but the Sunnis have been affected the most by the group. We are still inside the courthouse when we hear voices on the radio. Apparently, there is something going on outside. Finally, we find out why there is no one in the village. on the other side of the village, a queue of cars, from trucks to private cars, have lined up on the exit way. No one opens fire, because the vehicles turn out to be those of the village residents, who had to flee the place in a hurry. After seeing the PMU forces, they have returned with fear and tremble. The Daesh terrorist group had told the residents that the PMU forces would massacre them upon reaching the village. That's why the poor villagers are afraid. But little by little, reality shows itself to them. The PMU forces gradually mingle with the crowds, ensuring them there is nothing to fear and that they'll be safe. We may call Daesh a Sunni group, but Sunnis are not like Daesh. By looking at the people's ID cards and their Shia and Sunni names, we can see that there had been no sectarian differences here prior to Daesh's arrival. Even if the plates of Daesh cars were not left behind, it was possible to guess who supported them.
Saudi.
Women and children know that the village has been liberated by the PMU, but they're still afraid. They fear that Daesh might return and execute them for welcoming the fighters. But younger children soon start to trust the fighters. All that Daesh has left for these people is fear. Fear that won't let go of them, even for a moment. Daesh portrayed the PMU forces as pagans that say their prayers toward the city of Karbala, worship Imam Hussein, have a different prophet and a different Quran, and are the enemies of Sunnis. But the villagers now see a different reality. Now I understand why the Americans were so afraid of the PMU's participation in the Mosul operation. This city is what scares them. They fear the birth of yet another popular force like Hezbollah in Lebanon, this time in Iraq. But maybe it's too late for them to fear.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
New data shows that the UK housing market has slumped. According to new figures, demand for new homes in the UK has dropped as families cannot afford increased mortgage costs. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, house prices in the UK fell at the fastest annual rate seen in 12 years last month. Britain's major mortgage lender, Halifax, announced this week. Prices for June dropped for the third month in a row by 2.6% year-on-year, after a 1.1% fall in May, and the largest decline since June 2011, according to Halifax. The average cost of a home in Britain totaled £285,932 last month, the lender said in a statement. The latest slump comes as soaring mortgage rates, driven by a series of interest rate hikes by the Bank of England to curb inflation, have sent jitters through the housing market. Kim Kennard, the director of Halifax Mortgages, said that the resulting squeeze on affordability will inevitably act as a brake on demand as buyers consider what they can realistically afford. Concerns about persistent inflation have led to a significant increase in the cost of funding, according to Kinnaird. Coupled with the base rate rising by another 5/10 percentage points to 5%, this contributed to a big jump in typical mortgage rates over the last month. With markets now forecasting a peak in bank rate of over 6%, the likelihood is that mortgage rates will remain higher for longer, and the squeeze on household finances will continue to put downward pressure on house prices over the coming year, he added. Traders are expecting the Bank of England to further increase rates to 6.5% by December, which would be the highest level since 1998. Analysts project house prices in the UK to drop as much as 10% from their peak in the summer of last year. Also in the UK, there are other concerning news about food insecurity. According to new data, 1 in 7 people in the UK faced hunger last year due to a lack of money. Research by food bank charity the Trussell Trust revealed recently. The survey said this equated to an estimated 11.3 million people, which is more than double Scotland's population. Ethnic minorities, disabled people, and carers were among those most affected, with researchers linking food insecurity to the cost of living crisis in the UK that is showing little sign of abating. The Trussell Trust runs more than 1,200 food banks across its network, which is around 2/3 of the UK total. The charity said it provided a record 3 million food parcels in the year to March, a 37% surge and more than double the amount delivered 5 years ago. It added that the latest findings were just the tip of the iceberg. About 7% of Britain's population was provided with charitable food support in the year to meet 2022, while 71% of people facing food shortages said they had not yet accessed any such support. Trussell Trust Chief Executive Emma Reevy said food banks are not the answer when people are going without the essentials in one of the richest economies in the world. We need a social security system which provides protection and the dignity for people to cover their own essentials, such as food and bills. UK households are facing the biggest two-year squeeze in living standards since records began in 1950s, as a spiraling inflation eats away at pay growth for workers in almost all sectors of the economy. The report said, this consistent upward trajectory exposes that it is weaknesses in the social security system of the UK that are driving food bank need rather than just a pandemic or cost of living crisis. Food inflation in the world's sixth largest economy was running at 18.3% in May and 14.6% in June, according to the most recent official data. Consumer price growth in Britain remains persistently high, despite government efforts to tame inflation, with officials and trade unions accusing supermarkets of greedflation and profiteering at the expense of consumers.
Face to face. Hello, welcome to the program Face to Face. I'm Kavitat Wade. Well, today we have the pleasure of having an interview with the Indonesian ambassador to Iran, His Excellency Ambassador Rani Prasetyo Yudhiyantoro. Now, the reason why we chose to have an interview with him is because Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, just came off his trip from Indonesia, and he called the relationship between the two countries after his trip a turning point. Well, we're going to find out what kind of turning point that is. Excellency Ambassador Rani Prasetyo Yudhiyantoro, welcome to the program. And thanks for, thank you for giving us your time. As I just mentioned, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, fresh off his trip from Indonesia, talked about the context of Iran-Indonesia bilateral ties and regional cooperation, which obviously is in the works, in terms of how the world is gradually moving towards what's called multilateralism and multipolarity. Can you tell us how you evaluate the visit by the Iranian president to your country?
Okay. I would like to say that the visit of Excellency President Raisi to Indonesia was very successful. And, of course, bilaterally, the visit itself is opening the windows of cooperation between Indonesia and Iran more widely, and of course it's going to be the positive impact on our relations in the future, especially in the economic relations. And this visit, I believe, also gave opportunity for both countries to strengthen, to increase, to enhance their cooperation at the multilateral levels, whether within the framework of international or regional organizations such as United Nations, D8, IOC, or IORA, etc.
Well, that's great. That's how the Iranian president has also talked about Indonesia, in terms of it being a window for Iran to open up its market with Indonesia and expand from there. Now, the country signed what was called a preferential trade agreement, which I'm sure you're well aware of, in order to expand these economic relations between the two. How significant was that?
What I see is the visit of President Raisi to Indonesia had been heavy emphasized on economic, science, and technology cooperation. And, of course, I also say that I would like to say that the visit also